Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Many of us love genealogy, the study of family history and where we come from. New technologies have made unlocking family secrets significantly easier. From adoptees finding their birth parents, to children created with assisted reproduction being able to track down their biological parents. In a new book, author Libby Copeland beautifully explores this world of consumer-based genetic testing. With merely a cheek swab or spit sample, we can learn things about ourselves that only a generation ago would have seemed impossible. From predispositions to certain medical conditions, to parentage, ancestry, and kinship, now even law enforcement, direct-to-consumer genetic testing holds seemingly limitless promise. But there's a cost to it as well, privacy, as some people find secrets, or more likely, are found out in ways they never anticipated. Libby Copeland is an award-winning journalist who spent a decade at the Washington Post and is now a freelance writer. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, Slate, The New York Times, New Republic, Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company, among many others. Her meticulously researched and reported new book is called The Lost Family: How DNA Testing is Upending Who We Are, and it's published by Abrams. Author Libby Copeland is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Libby Copeland, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just define what you mean by what is a genetic genealogist as opposed to sort of the regular old kind?
Yeah. Hey, John. Thanks for having me. That's a great question. So genealogists can be genetic genealogists, or they can be more comfortable just using the paper trail and doing their research and looking at archival materials. And, you know, most genealogists started out that way if they've been doing it for a long time, because they started out during an era when there was not such a thing as DNA testing, and there may not have even been the internet. But genetic genealogy is distinguished by the fact that you're using your DNA information in concert with genealogical records to better understand your family history and sometimes to break through what genealogists like to refer to as brick walls, which are those problems that you just can't see your way around. Because when you do DNA testing through a recreational DNA testing company, you get not only your ethnicity estimate, which is the pie chart that many people are familiar with, but you also get lists of genetic relatives. And if you find, for instance, a second cousin, you don't know who that second cousin is. If you can collaborate on some research or do some research to understand how that person is related to you, it may help you better understand your own family history.
Well, and the thing about the genetic revolution here, and as you call it, recreational DNA testing, because it really is what it is, people have, it's exploded, really. And so genealogy used to be more of the domain of like serious hobbyists who really had to pursue this and use libraries and archives, as you mentioned, and the paper trail. And it was maybe a bit more esoteric. I mean, many of us had questions about our grandparents or great-grandparents or things like that. But this has led to this quantum explosion. And so you have some estimates, or you actually interviewed some people who made estimates. How many people have spit in a tube or done a cheek swab?
Yeah, so there have been actually over 35 million consumer DNA kits sold for the purposes of understanding ancestry and genealogy. When I wrote the book, it was 30 million, but it's gone up, and it keeps going up, even though to some extent sales have slowed. That number just keeps rising, albeit more slowly. So 35 million test kits sold, that's about 35 million people. There's a little bit of overlap between the four main companies. And the vast majority of those people are American, about 80%. Of people who are testing are American, and in many cases, those are people who, you know, may feel cut off from their roots, and they're super curious about that one grandfather and where he really came from, or better understanding, you know, their family histories and how they got here.
That was one really interesting thing that culturally that Americans seem more interested in this, and I guess because we are the ultimate melting pot, and have left the mother country generations ago. That maybe, but it's also, it seems like there's a preponderance of women who become seekers, as you call them. What are seekers?
So seekers are people who become sort of obsessed with understanding just what's in their genes and what that can tell them about who they are. And, you know, seekers can be people who are longtime genealogists who decided to do DNA to, better understand their genealogical results and to help them. Or they can be people who set out looking for an answer to a question. So for instance, someone who's adopted who has not been able to access information about their birth parents because of various state laws may turn to DNA testing to find out the identity of their birth parents, or someone who doesn't know the identity of their father, or someone who's donor conceived. And then the sort of third category of seekers, which was a category that really interested me, was those who enter into this very casually, right? DNA test kits can cost $99. They can cost $59 during a sale. And so they're seen as a very low investment form of entertainment. People give them as gifts around Christmas. And very often, we don't sort of assume that something surprising is going to happen, but for a significant minority of people, something really, truly surprising does come out of the results. And those people, that third category of seekers, are people who do a DNA test as a kind of a, you know, maybe they were never interested in genealogy. They just kind of fall into this rabbit hole because all of a sudden it's in the results that something surprising is revealed, and now suddenly they have 1,000 questions and they need to find out more. And they go on to the internet and they start looking at their DNA relatives, and it's really the beginning of a very long journey for them.
Not to spoil anything in the book, because you do tell, you tell many stories, but you frame the narrative around a particular seeker by the name of Alice Collins Playbuke, who is really wonderful because she starts in the early days as a hobby looking at genealogy and always wondering. And then she's got some scientific aptitude, so she is able to kind of move into the sort of new generation of technology. And she's very organized and has spreadsheets and winds up going over birth records. But she's an example. But there are others in the book who, for example, let's say you're raised in a family that you identifies as Irish Catholic, but then somebody casually gives out one of these tests as a holiday gift, as you point out, sort of as a casual kind of, oh, find out more about yourself. And then you turn out to have some surprising news in the ancestry DNA.
Right. Yeah, there's so many different ways that this can play out. So for a lot of people, the first clue is that they get this pie chart, this ethnicity estimate pie chart, and it is not what they expected, right? They understand themselves to be wholly Irish American, for instance. And in fact, they are, as in the case of Alice, half Ashkenazi Jewish by genetic ancestry. And then they're like, how can that be? I don't quite understand. And for Alice, sort of the book takes you through, you know, the explanation, which is very surprising and takes her years to unravel. It's not sort of one of the more expected scenarios. But the more expected scenarios are, first, something like that would be often what's called in this world an NPE, which stands for non-paternity event or not parent expected. And that is one when one of your parents, typically your father, is not genetically related to you. And that can be a truly life-altering experience. It can be really profoundly dislocating and invite a lot of curiosity and digging on the part of the seeker who discovers this and now wants to understand, okay, well, so who is my genetic father and what sense can I make out of this and how does this change my identity? There are cases where somebody discovers that they were adopted and were never told, and I write about a woman to whom that happens. She discovers she's adopted at the age of 51 when she takes an ancestry test. And there are those who discover that they were donor-conceived, or maybe they go in knowing they were donor-conceived, but they discover that they have many, many more siblings than they ever could have anticipated, so 20, 50, sometimes upwards of 100 half-siblings through the same donor father. So all of these kinds of discoveries invite all these questions about, you know, what is family? How do I see myself now that my understanding of my family and my genetic connections is altered? What is a father? How does this change my relationship with the man who raised me? And they're incredibly profound questions, and I wanted to spend time with people, you know, interview them over months and even years to understand how DNA testing is basically raising what I would see as essential human questions. So these are questions that are relevant to all of us, whether or not you ever take a DNA test. And causing us to really grapple with the legacy of family secrets that were kept 50, 60, 100 years ago and how they still live in us and still invite great moments of reckoning even now.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Libby Copeland, who's a longtime journalist based in New York, who's written a fabulous new book called The Lost Family, How DNA Testing is Upending Who We Are. And Libby, you alluded to these non-paternity events. And one of your sources that you interview in the book estimates, I think it was at the very high end, it's possible there are 30%, did I read that right? But that maybe more realistically, it's something like 1% to 2% per year. How do you reconcile that? Is it that many times we don't actually know who the father is?
Yeah, so 30% is a number that's been out there for a long time. But the most reliable population studies that I've read suggest it's about 2%. So 2% non-paternity event rate across populations. And if you sort of track that out across say, 35 million people testing, it winds up becoming a significant number. But you also have to consider that there are situations where you discover, for instance, a half-sibling, but not necessarily because your father is not genetically related to you. So, for instance, one of your parents conceived a child, had a child, perhaps before you were born, perhaps before they were even married to your other parent. And then there's a lot of other sort of categories. There's the possibility of finding out that you, for instance, were adopted without knowing it, which I sort of consider a separate category. And there's people who experience that, you know, they know the identities of their genetic relations, but there was some very important fundamental secret kept from them, for instance, that their genetic ancestry isn't what they thought it was because it was hidden from them to protect them from, for instance, racial discrimination. So, you know, there are people who, African-Americans who chose to pass as white, and over the generations, that truth was suppressed or forgotten or not passed on for whatever reason. And so I write in the book about a man to whom that happens. He was not told he was part African-American because his mother was trying to protect him. So when you look at the suite of ways that this can play out, you're talking about well over a million Americans who are uncovering some really major surprise when they spit into a tube. And then within that, when each person makes that discovery, of course, that affects your immediate family and maybe another family that you may be genetic related to. So you're talking about millions of Americans who are grappling with this now. And it's a profound change, actually, to our culture and to the American family.
Well, one of the things you write, or I should say many of the subjects that you interview, seem to feel, and of course we should acknowledge there's probably selection bias because these are people who obviously have gotten very involved and been involved with this for a long time and found some of their family secrets. And it seems as though the tendency is toward being in control of the information gives some levity or some ability to integrate it. That in fact, what's interesting is that this genetic information may, you could have a secret revealed to you, even though you haven't been the one necessarily to spit in the tube. And that's one of the fascinating issues you tackle later in the book about privacy, which is that how private is this information?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We've essentially reached a tipping point whereby all of us in America, or nearly all of us, are essentially implicated by this technology, whether or not we ever choose to test. And that's because if, for instance, you're a man who helped conceive a child 40 years ago and didn't even know it, maybe, right, in high school and didn't even realize it, if that child, that genetic child is looking for you, that child may be able to find you by spitting into a tube, even if you're not in a database. So even if you never decide to spit into a tube through 23andMe or Ancestry, the decision of a first cousin to do so, the decision of a sibling, an adult child, even a second or third cousin, could effectively make you findable. And that's because the power of our shared DNA in those databases, when combined with the power of social media and the internet and the ability to do genealogical research, means that people can essentially assemble family trees and fill in the missing pieces. So this means that, to get back to what you were starting to say earlier, which has to do with the power of agency, what I found over and over again was that people who were in charge of testing and then figuring out what to do with maybe surprising information that they'd found seemed to find themselves in a better position than those who sometimes were on the other side of it, right? Either they were the keeper of a genetic secret, perhaps they had decided not to reveal to a child that they were donor conceived, for instance, or somebody who didn't know about the secret but sort of had it come to them. That can be more difficult to process because it's happening more quickly, not on your own timeline, and because you are not the one to make sense out of your DNA results, and there's something that seems to take place, at least people have told me, with the ability to process that information and make sense of it, that seems to make people feel empowered by this information. So that even when something is deeply traumatizing at the beginning, often people will say that knowing this truth about their own genetic origins, when it came to them by way of spitting into a tube themselves, is something that they're glad to know. But that's not always true for the people that they're making contact with.
And moreover, in terms of the privacy, you have a whole chapter on how genetic testing, this recreational or direct-to-consumer genetic testing, is now used in solving old crimes, most famously the California killer. Can you share how that happened? Because I still have a hard time understanding it, but it seems irrefutable that they found the right person who literally had raped and murdered, I think, dozens of women in California.
Yeah, the Golden State Killer.
Golden State Killer.
Yeah, the Golden State Killer, and this happened just over 2 years ago. So what they did was they used techniques that adopted persons have been using for almost a decade now. So these were not new techniques. They were new in the context of solving crimes. And what law enforcement did was they worked with a genetic genealogist named Barbara Ray Venter, and they used a kind of quasi-public database called GEDmatch, which is a place where when you test through a major company, you can download your results and upload them to GEDmatch so that you can compare DNA across different platforms. So even if, you know, if I tested at Ancestry and you tested at 23andMe and we both download our information and then upload it to GEDmatch, you and I can find each other if we're genetically related. And what they did was they put the crime DNA, so the crime scene DNA, into GEDmatch, and they used that information to find distant cousins, third and fourth cousins. And then they used genealogical materials to build up to find recent common ancestors, and then they used social media and other resources on the internet to build down and to find about five or six men who were likely candidates to fit the profile of being this particular criminal. And when they were able to narrow in on one, the police then used a kind of a method that it would be legally admissible, which is they matched the DNA left behind by the man they suspected. Say they might do it by if a man discards a tissue in a public place, and they match that against the crime scene DNA, and then they're able to make an arrest. So this was a kind of extraordinary new use, and it led to somewhat of a privacy uproar. A lot of Americans were in favor of it because it's been used in many cases against serial killers and sort of, you know, in cases of homicides and rapes and really the worst kinds of crimes. There were some legal experts who were concerned about the use of this, about the fact that, you know, this was DNA that was originally intended for people to do genealogical research. It was being used in a different way, and who see this as not quite right and not quite in keeping with the Fourth Amendment. So it's been interesting to watch that play out. I think there's been close to or more than 200 cases solved in this way using genetic genealogy methods and these quasi-public databases like GEDmatch.
Right. And it's easy to see why I think privacy experts would be up in arms, although I'd say probably the general public is probably pretty glad that we're able to track down some of these very elusive criminals. I mean, it is complicated, and it raises those questions too in terms of privacy on the certainly on the less harrowing spectrum. Just, you know, what if you have some secret yourself and you don't want it revealed, or you don't even think you're entering this this genetic database reveal, and yet the evidence can be used kind of circumstantially to piece the puzzle together. One quote you had in the book, I think it was from one of the founders of these consumer companies. He said that the whole idea of an anonymous sperm donor nowadays is an oxymoronic term, kind of like jumbo shrimp. That
yeah.
is, men who donate sperm, and I was in medical school, I didn't do it, but many of my classmates thought, hey, I can get, you know, $25 if I donate sperm, are now finding out that they have actually fathered many children.
Yep. Yeah, that was Bennett Greenspan who said that to me. He's the founder of the oldest DNA testing company in America, Family Tree DNA. And I mean, he's been saying that for years. He, in fact, he's kind of a funny guy, and he goes around and makes speeches. And one of the laugh lines that he would deliver to audiences was he would say to all the grandparents in the audience, I suggest that you send your grandsons beer money in college, because otherwise they might donate sperm to get beer money. And, you know, within a few years, they're going to have someone knocking on their door saying, hey, Dad. Right.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, it's very interesting, because the collision of DNA testing with another technology, which is the fertility industry, one technology is sort of bringing to light the limitations of contracts within the other technology. So for years, fertility labs, sperm banks would promise anonymity to these fathers. The fathers never had, the donors never had an anticipation, neither did any of us, that this would ever cease to be. I interviewed a man who now knows himself to have 24 children, two of them he raised, and 22 of them through sperm donations he made in the 1970s. And I mean, he was flabbergasted, all of us were, and never could have anticipated it, and has had to really delicately and carefully and with great concern for the daughters he raised, navigate relationships with these genetic children who in some cases want relationships with him, in some cases don't, in which case that's fine. Like, he's very deferential and respectful. But, you know, it's a position that he never imagined himself to be put in. And there's many, many American men who are right now experiencing what this means, that they are fathers, unbeknownst to themselves, in some cases, you know, with upwards of 50 children or more.
And I note too early on in the book, there are a number of these companies springing up, including one that has the very sort of catchy name, Who's the Daddy? I was kind of surprised by that.
Yeah, well, you know, Who's the Daddy was interesting to me because I write in one section about there's a kind of a Wild West quality to some of the DNA testing. So, you know, my research primarily focused on the four major companies, Ancestry, 23andMe, MyHeritage, and FamilyTree DNA. And I've read their consent policies and their privacy policies. And, you know, you can read them and you can see that they're publicly available and you can decide if you feel comfortable with them. But there's a lot of companies out there, sometimes with names like, you know, Who's the Daddy, where they may or may not have consent policies publicly visible or at all. They may not have privacy policies. One of the companies I write about, you know, they're like a surreptitious testing company. So you're advised that you can send in, for instance, like a toothpick or a cigarette butt and have it DNA tested, I guess, to see, like, if your partner's cheating on you, and if so, who with, right? And so, you know, there's really a lack of regulation in this field, and that's an American thing, and that's sort of where we are now. But it can be, to some extent, a kind of a buyer beware situation because, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. If you do give your genetic material to a company, and then years later that company gets sold and there was no protections for you, and maybe that company never even made you any promises, you know, you do have to be very thoughtful about the implications that could take shape down the road.
Libby, I wanted to just ask you a little bit. We talked about seekers. On the other end of the spectrum are the search angels. These are some interesting characters. And one in particular you feature a lot and who seems to have really found herself is someone named CeCe Moore. Tell us about CeCe Moore, who she is.
Yeah, so CeCe Moore is a genetic genealogist who began testing and became involved in DNA testing very early on. DNA testing has been around for 20 years, although not in the form that we know of it today. And she became involved fairly early on, and she saw that there was kind of an open field in terms of putting together the DNA with genealogy, and she began to try to study her own family and what testing among her cousins and her relatives could, how that could help her piece together her family tree. And she also became a search angel. And a search angel is somebody who generally for free, and are usually women, which is interesting, volunteers their time to help somebody else understand a family mystery, typically an immediate family history. So very early on, search angels worked often with people who are adopted, who very much wanted to know the identity of one or both of their birth parents, and a search angel could help them put their DNA information together with genealogical research and help them unravel that puzzle, which can be incredibly complicated, especially back 10 years ago when the databases were very small. This research could take literally years. So CeCe Moore has now moved into the space of doing investigative genetic genealogy, which is work with law enforcement. And she's the subject of a recent TV show, The Genetic Detective. And so she's somebody who has made quite a name for herself sort of in this field and wearing different hats. And she was a fascinating person to research. I first talked to her back in 2017, and she told me Alice's story, Alice being the kind of protagonist of the book. And then we kept talking over the years as her work developed.
Well, and she kind of went full circle because she, I guess, started her career wanting to be an actor and was on television, but it was, you know, acting is hard and getting parts is hard. And so she found this passion and now has kind of come back and been on TV and helped on other shows, including the Henry Louis Gates show, Finding Your Roots on PBS, where she's been a consultant. It's really interesting. So, Libby, I wonder, you've written this book now, and people must, I saw on Twitter where people reach out to you thinking you know so much about this. Did they think of you as a search angel?
Yeah, so people reach out to me quite a bit. You know, the book started actually back in 2017 when I got hundreds of emails from people who wanted to tell me about their DNA testing surprises after I had written an article about the topic for the Washington Post. And so now, still, after the book came out, I still get quite a bit of people who've now read the book, and they say, wow, and let me tell you my story. And sometimes, yeah, they want advice, and I say, I'm definitely not an expert. Like, I'm a journalist, but I'm not a genetic genealogist, so I can't help you unravel your family history. But you know, here's somebody who could, or here's an organization that could, or here's a Facebook group where you might be able to find resources. There's not a ton of resources for people. They primarily exist on Facebook in these groups. And one of the things I'm hoping can come in coming years is increasing support, particularly in the mental health community, for people who experience a DNA surprise and really need help, you know, processing it and getting through it and processing what can be a very traumatic experience. Because right now, if you're looking for instance, a therapist to help you understand how you just discovered at the age of 60 that you are, for instance, donor conceived, the man who raised you wasn't genetically related to you and he's no longer alive and you can't have a conversation with him, like, that's a lot of stuff to process and can honestly take perhaps the rest of a lifetime to really understand. There's not a whole lot of psychologists who exist to hold your hand through that, at least not ones who sort of specialize in the specific shape of what that looks like. And I'm seeing more kind of coming up, and I'm hoping that increasingly there will be yet more, because I think it's an important experience that more and more Americans are going to be going through.
Yeah, so I guess by way of final question, how fast do you think this will continue to grow? I mean, how many more Americans are predicted to look at their own DNA or family history?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, in the last 6 to 9 months, there's been a bit of a slowdown in DNA testing. The numbers are still going up, but for many years, for about 3 or 4 or 5 years, they were going up so rapidly. It was almost like, it was such a steep slope. It was hard to believe, and it was frankly impossible to maintain. So it has slowed somewhat, and the companies are making a pivot towards now more health-related testing. So they're offering that more so than they did before. Companies that were not in that space have gotten into that space within the last year or so. So what that means is that the numbers of people entering the databases are going to continue to grow, though perhaps for different reasons. They will no doubt find out family history and ethnicity estimates. And so I think, I can't put a number on it, but I do think that this is a phenomenon that is definitely not going away. And as DNA testing becomes of interest to people in other countries, it's going to become a widespread phenomenon. And it may be that we as Americans may have something to teach the world in terms of how, you know, what it's like to go through experiences like these, and maybe best practices for how to handle reaching out to genetic kin and, you know, emotionally processing the surprise that can come in a vial.
Well, it's a fabulous book. It's beautifully researched, well written, and also gorgeously presented with color plates and things. It's a stunning presentation. The name of it is The Lost Family: How DNA Testing is Upending Who We Are, and it's by our guest today, Libby Copeland, who is a longtime journalist. Libby, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, John, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Libby Copeland is a longtime journalist. Her new book is The Lost Family: How DNA Testing is Upending Who We Are. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWJS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.